partner doesn't eat, we don't eat. And so we see success through the client's eyes, not necessarily through our own eyes. And so that helps us create a better understanding of what KPIs, key performance indicators, a client may expect from us, and so that we can meet them at that expectation. And making sure that everyone in the company understands what we do kind of helps us breathe and live that philosophy from the ground up.
Welcome to ProCo 360's Pro Business Colorado. It's a show about entrepreneurs who could be successful anywhere and choose Colorado. I'm your host, Dave Tabor. My guests know that business in Colorado is special. Past shows, my Audible book list, and subscriber information all are available at ProCo360.com. Again, that's ProCo360.com. In this episode, I'll be speaking with Joe Altman, CEO of PIN Business Network, a fast-growing Colorado company helping its clients harness and apply data in ways that spur growth. We'll talk about how PIN has grown to $60 million without outside funding, and Joe will share a couple of examples that will get you thinking of how companies have used data to grow sales. Joe, thanks for joining me on ProCo 360.
Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, glad Joe's here. I really do want to dig into this whole notion of using data because it's in the news all the time. And first, though, I want to thank the show sponsors, Community Banks of Colorado. They go big for small business. They've been committed to this show since it started, demonstrating their love for entrepreneurs. Also, MicroStar Keg Logistics. These guys are entrepreneurs for beer entrepreneurs. MicroStar is a Colorado-based company that helps craft brewers expand by handling the logistics of keg distribution. So, Joe Altman of PIN Business Network, ready?
Absolutely.
I'll give a quick overview of Joe's company. Founded in 2010, PIN Business Network is one of the fastest growing marketing and innovation platforms in the country. Their clients include Under Armour, University of Denver, Papa John's, and many, many, many smaller and larger companies. So, Joe, why don't you give us a deeper understanding of what PIN does and the problems it solves for your clients?
Sure. We started out, we've pivoted a couple times, and about 3 years ago, we made a decision that data was probably the thing we should follow the most. We started studying what Google does in the marketplace, what Facebook does in the marketplace, and looking at the algorithms that they deployed in order to find customers for businesses. So we follow that same type of mentality on data. So we're a data marketing company. We're a company that uses data to deploy messaging in the marketplace in a place where we can find the person at intent that's looking for that particular product or service. You know, you hear a lot of different things that are said in the marketplace about how data is deployed and what channels are deployed in. And because we are industry agnostic and channel agnostic, we have the ability to make a decision on where someone is likely to receive that message. We use this thing called a 3D principle. It's data, discipline, and deployment. We deploy data with discipline. That allows us to drive down cost while increasing the effective reach of that message in the marketplace.
So give us an example of where you mentioned person plus intent. And obviously that would be the holy grail of marketing, right? Find the right person when they want to buy whatever it is you're selling. Can you give us a bit of an example of that so we can really understand the power of what you're doing?
Yeah, so we use a system that relies on quality scores, relevancy factors, correlations of data. We append that data back, and we build personas, the DNA of the actual individual. You know, and the data that we're actually talking about is not privatized data, so it's not social security numbers or, you know, date of birth or anything like that, but it's the psychographic, demographic, geographic data down from all the way down to race, religion, political affiliation, job.
How do you get it?
We use our system in order to watch people's actions in the marketplace. So
online or otherwise?
Online. Mm-hmm. So it's a digital strategy. We have been able to append to that traditional or offline strategies as well. But the concept behind it is that we don't want to sell hairbrushes to bald guys. We don't want to put a message in front of someone that's not likely to engage with it. So we want to find people that are actively engaged and looking for those particular products or services. We are the first, the only first-party data aggregator that does not share its data in the marketplace. So we deploy this system called Prometheus Intelligence Technology. It's the brain behind it. It creates AI. It learns. So it learns as people's habits and behaviors change. It learns those habits and behaviors and then can better understand what channel they're likely to engage with.
So, well, how do you know me? Like, how do you know that, I mean, if I clear my cookies or, you know, clear the cache or whatever on my system, how do you manage to keep data about me?
Well, the problem is that in the marketplace, you're constantly giving up data, right? Whether that you're giving someone access to, you know, GPS coordinates by using, you know, mapping technology on your cell phones down to, you know, connecting via internet browsers on your computer, even down to where you go, right? So there's geomarks and geolocations that are actually created based on signals that you have on your phone. So there's ways to get off the grid. But the reality of it is if you have an email address and you open those email addresses or open those emails, and if you engage in any sort of behavior on the internet at all, you're going to leave a footprint. Mm-hmm. Now, whether or not I get 100% of that footprint or 80%,
yeah,
that's going to dictate what kind of messaging and what I'm willing to spend in the marketplace in order to reach that particular
individual. So your clients, the more complete a picture of an individual you have, the more your client finds that of value.
Right. So we basically call this the difference between playing chess and checkers. We play chess. Most marketing companies out there play checkers. They're just not asking the right questions. They're not digging far enough into the data. And so we operate more like a proprietary trade desk or a stock market, turning up what works and down what doesn't so that we're not spending money inefficiently and we're finding people that are likely to engage in that particular market.
So do I have an involuntary account within your systems?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it an involuntary account. Personas are built individually, and then we basket those based on the attributes of that particular
person. So you don't
know
me specifically, but I might have – but there's an identifier of me in the system with all of the attributes you've been able to collect that then your customers are willing to pay for to find me when they want me.
Right. So we build shadows or mirror images of what people
So you could never tie it back specifically to me as a human – and yet I'm identified by my qualities.
Correct.
Got it.
And we use some appending software in the background to make sure that we're validating that information because, you know, the difference, the 1 degree you can be off is the difference between Hawaii and Alaska, right? And you don't want to end up on the shores of Alaska in shorts and a t-shirt in the middle of winter.
Wow. So. This sounds like incredibly powerful.
It is very powerful, and we've had some amazing success with it, both on the SMB, small to medium business side, all the way up to enterprise-level clients.
That's what really intrigued me, and I want to talk about, as I was preparing to speak with you today, the notion that you serve small clients and huge clients. And typically, in my experience, a company that does what you do has to either mostly targets really big ones who can afford to pay a lot, but you've got some really interesting small business success stories too. Can you map one out really clear, like a specific example of a small business that's been able to really use what you do for them?
Yeah, so we have a vet. I use this as an example. We have a vet clinic that has been our client now for about 2.5 years.
A single veterinary clinic?
Single location. And demographically, you would think that they wouldn't be able to create the type of revenue they've been able to create in their environment. So we took them, without talking specifically about their revenue, we took them from use round numbers, a couple $1 million in revenue in over a two and a half year period of time, we were able to more than double the revenue in that particular location.
So what did you do for them basically, you know, to drive, obviously you drove new customers to them.
Yeah. So
how did you do that?
So blocking it, we call it blocking and tackling, right? So there's the things that every agency in the marketplace is going to be able to do for a client, SEM strategies such as AdWords and social strategies such as Facebook and Instagram and those things. We have the relationships with those particular organizations, and those are called direct spend strategies. But how you put a message in those environments is going to be dictated by the type of data that you're able to collect on your side. So we collect data and we spool that data, and then we find people in the marketplace after examining who's already doing business with them that look like the customers that are already engaging with them. And so by being able to do that, I can be more targeted in who I put that message in front of that was likely to identify with the type of...
So can you... I know I interrupted you, and I do that a lot.
That's
okay. But the So if someone's got an old cat versus a puppy, you'll be sending them a different automated message or ad or whatever?
Well, yeah. So we have message segmentation, so we'll build different messages for different types of people. but we found that there's certain triggers and identifiers in the marketplace that people are likely to engage with. What we're trying to do is not give away products in the marketplace. We want them to value the product or service that we're representing, but we want to build positive sentiment. And if we can build positive sentiment in the marketplace by talking to that particular person in a way they're likely to engage with that message, you have a higher degree of sentiment, which leads to a higher commitment or lead value for that particular business, which leads to a higher conversion value, which reduces how much money they have to spend in the marketplace.
So let's be more specific. What kind of message might you have sent to somebody for the veterinary clinic?
Well, let's hypothetically say that someone has a cat or a dog that's 18 years old, and they're searching out on the internet for euthanasia or, you know, end of life scenarios. We will basically take a message within that particular environment and put it in front of them in a way they're likely to engage.
What kind of message?
Something that may talk about that your pet's had a good life, or that, you know, hey, you know, we have a caring way of, you know, helping you or counseling you through this.
And your data that you've collected helps you find that person and message that out to them.
Yes.
So who writes the message?
We have about 11 different departments. We have a creative department. We have a narrative department, or writers on staff, and they'll write certain messages in marketplace. So all those departments work together to create messaging in advance. So we build what we see people actually engaging with. We build messages for that particular business in those particular areas that they represent.
Well, then finally, my other question is, so how much did this company spend in order to double their sales from a couple of million to whatever, double?
In this particular case, their budget started off very small, $3,000 a month in budget, and we've worked it way up to, you know, I think they spend somewhere between $8,000 and $10,000 a month.
Yeah. So, got it. So, and when you think about the payback, it's not a difficult thing. And do you treat big companies like Under Armour, for example, do you treat them differently? Do you provide different services or just more?
Well, we have different services. So we're a full-stack marketing solution. So the capabilities that we have internally can't be matched by a single agency. And then our overall ability to measure data makes us more powerful. So we can take a small budget and make it more effective. We can take a big budget and make it extremely more effective. But then we can start actually cutting back on what we spend to make sure we're effectively reaching the right people. And we're not overspending. We call that, you know, the spray and pray approach companies do. And we have a more targeted, singular approach to
it. Is that how you've been able to grow your business from to 60 million versus what many other agencies, you know, that kind of stop in the $2-4 million range?
Well, I think one of the problems with most agencies in the marketplace is that they overpromise and underdeliver, and they don't actually take enough time to educate businesses on why it's important to spend money in different areas. They don't hold themselves accountable. And so, you know, the more we actually create opportunities and have these case studies of businesses doing extremely well, the more other people find out about us, and it's kind of a revolving wheel.
Obviously, getting customers to find you is one of the holy grails of running a company, right? As opposed to having to go find them and chase them and hunt them and so forth. Hey, I'm going to remind our listeners that you're listening to ProCo 360's Pro Business Colorado. I'm your host, Dave Tabor, and this is the show featuring entrepreneurs and business leaders who could be successful anywhere and choose Colorado. I'm speaking with Joe Altman, CEO of PIN Business Network. Let's talk about the notion of data some more. And your company has six beliefs listed on its website, and we may speak about some of the others during our conversation, but let's start with the first, which is data-centric. You say we are a data company that happens to do digital marketing. And that reminded me of Zappos, you know, a service company that happens to sell shoes. So it seems like that is a strong differentiator for you. Is that how you use it?
Yeah, so the discipline of how you deploy data makes all the difference in the world. And when, you know, companies out there say that they're a marketing company, they're concentrating on the message, not necessarily the method. And there's only two things that actually should matter in the marketplace, and that is message or method, right? And when we talk about the message you're deploying, we can make adjustments to that message in order to, so we're reading the data, we're reading how people are engaging with that message in order to figure out whether or not that message is effective in the marketplace. And if it is it effective with enough people? Can we reach enough people with that message to make it worth the amount of money that people have to spend in order to get a return? The other side of that is method. Well, if you're spending all of your money on social strategies or all of your money on SEM, which is, you know, AdWords or with Google, mm-hmm. you're missing other opportunities in the marketplace to reach people on a targeted basis.
Yep.
And so we take data and we consume that, and we have data analysts that work on staff that work to kind of perfect the direction of what those personas or customers look like for that business. And that allows us to use data with intent the same way we're asking the consumer to use it.
Well, I want to shift from the notion of how you're serving your clients now to more of how you position your business. And I'm intrigued by this notion of the real popular rage now is people don't care what you do, they care why you do it. Simon Sinek's famous TED right. Talk, and everyone's talking about people don't care what you do, they care why you do it. And yet your strong focus is how you do it as a differentiator. And that, to me, that's different than why, you know, in your case, you're saying we care about how more than anyone else. And in fact, PIN is a certified Google Premier partner, and I want to talk about that because I'm super impressed that your entire team, including people in administrative roles, have passed exams in data marketing. In fact, I'm going to read all the tests because I think it's important, sort of to the point that I want to make. All of your staff has taken tests in AdWords fundamentals, search advertising, display advertising, mobile advertising, video advertising, shopping advertising, and here's my point, I guess, along with being data-centric as a differentiator. Another is that your entire team can speak this language to the customer and the services. And, you know, where does all that come from, this whole notion of speaking data, being data?
So we believe that cultures trump strategy every day of the week, right? And in that belief, we want to make sure that everyone understands, even at the simplest form within one channel, how difficult it is in order to read and analyze and understand data. And by having everyone in the company speak that language, when they're having a conversation with a customer, they can talk to, and it's not just Google, we do this for almost every platform we have, they can have a better understanding of what the customer's needs are and also what they're facing in the marketplace. But it gives everyone on the team the ability to appreciate what everyone else does on the team. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Can you think of any specific examples where someone in an administrative person at PIN or somebody who's not really a sales-facing person has relied on that background to help represent you well?
Yeah, so if we even started talking about our accounts payable or accounting systems, they have conversations with customers. Customers will ask questions about even things that show up on their bill. And by being able to understand all of those systems, they can talk directly to whether or not that customer should or should not be using that service, whether or not it's something that they'll bring attention to the customer to, hey, I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but this is also an opportunity. So it's everything happens at that point of intent, right? And so if you have answers, as regardless of where you are in the company, and you're educated on what we do, you have a better way. You're more likely to be able to communicate with our clients effectively.
Well, to me, that strikes me as an amazingly powerful differentiator, because if you're getting a bill paid, or if you're, you know, somebody from accounts payable is whatever, and you're saying, instead of saying, well, I don't really know what that is, let me have somebody call you back. They're like, well, this is what it is, and this is how it worked in your strategy. Not at least a basic level. I would think that does so much to solidify your position as a trusted expert as a business. That's really an impressive way to go.
Yeah. So our entire philosophy, our entire culture is, besides being data centric, we rely on the effectiveness of what we do on if our partner doesn't eat, we don't eat. And so we see success through the client's eyes, not necessarily through our own eyes. And so that helps us create a better understanding of what KPIs, key performance indicators, a client may expect from us, and so that we can meet them at that expectation. And making sure that everyone in the company understands what we do kind of helps us breathe and live that philosophy from the ground up, from cradle to grave, from the beginning of the mm-hmm. relationship all the way to the end.
Yeah, well, that it strikes me too that it dovetails with another one of the beliefs that you promoted on your website, which is humility. And in fact, I'm going to ask Luke to play a clip in just a second. And this clip is from a book called Extreme Ownership, How Navy SEALs Lead and Win. And I'd be interested in your take on it, how it fits. Go ahead, please, Luke.
We've made huge mistakes. Often our mistakes provided the greatest lessons, humbled us, and enabled us to grow and become better. For leaders, the humility to admit and own mistakes and develop a plan to overcome them is essential to success.
So what's your take? You've had mistakes, and one of the challenges I had when I ran a company, I was kind of a young leader, and I really struggled with the notion of owning my mistakes and feeling sort of inadequate in the face of them. What's your take on that?
You know, I run from people who haven't failed. So I think failure is the one thing that teaches us more about ourselves and the people around us than anything else. And I think that failure is a necessity, especially in our business. And I constantly tell clients that, look, we're going to fall down. We're going to get bloody. Things are not going to go well. And you have to expect that to happen as we start to figure out where the best place to find people that are likely to engage in your particular product or service. And so, you know, we call that leading from the front, being the one to take the first bullet. You know, the people in the company call me Mufasa. If you know anything about the Lion King,
yeah.
You know, he didn't make it out, but he led from the front. And I think that that type of mentality, when you're talking about taking a humble or servant leadership approach, helps us become better with our clients.
Yeah, and you've blown up in your terms. You've blown up at least one business in the past, right? You've lost money.
Yeah, I lost millions of dollars, mismanaged people and capital. I thought I was bulletproof, and I found out very quickly that money is difficult to make and easy to lose.
Yeah,
right. A fool and his money are soon parted.
Yeah,
and so I've made significant mistake. You know, that's probably the most catastrophic thing that happened. Unfortunately, it happened during the same, you know, 2006, 2007, 2008 era that everyone else had issues. But I was able to recover and learn from it, right? And study those things and make myself better.
Yeah. I mean, mismanaging money is, and I've done that too, is painful. It's embarrassing. Mismanaging people cuts deeper.
Yeah, it does.
I'm sure you've done that too.
Yeah, I have. And, you know, you don't realize at the time that, In your youthfulness, as you're younger, you make decisions, I think, that are more ego-driven. And as you get older, you take that more patient approach of looking at situations from all sides. But I have to tell you that if I wouldn't have failed, I wouldn't be half the business person or even half the person as far as character as I am today.
Yeah, I think that's a notion that's gaining traction now. As the entrepreneurial community becomes higher and higher profile, and I think people have grown to accept the fact that successful people have all failed. And I think that's healthy for the marketplace.
I think every person, no, maybe not every person, but I think people should go through a certain amount of adversity because I think it builds and creates character.
Well, you and I talked about that because we talked about raising kids.
Yeah.
And how do you, you know, as a parent, I'm thinking really specifically, not hypothetically, when you think about raising your kids and you think about failure, how do you approach that?
Well, I think that my kids, even seeing at a young age the failure that we experienced, I mean, it was catastrophic. But getting through that and showing them that, hey, you have to continue to move forward. You have to continue to, first of all, own the consequences of that failure and own what actually went wrong. That you have to own those things. And you can make excuses for this person did this and this person did that. And in reality, you had choices that you could have made differently that would have had a different result in that failure.
Do you do that at the office too? When you fail, do you talk with your people and say, yeah, this is how I messed up. This is what I'm doing about it. This is all that.
Yes. So I own failure. I'm the last one to take credit, right? I want the people within the company to take credit for the successes that we have. But on the other side, I want to be the first one to own the failure or any sort of fall down we have, even with the individual client.
Yeah.
So it's not uncommon for me to walk into a situation, whether it's a small business all the way up to an enterprise level client. And I always tell the people on the team, It does not matter if they spend a dollar with us or $1 million a month with us. We're going to treat every client the same way, walk them through the same process, because we have no idea where they are in their journey, both from a business maturity or business acumen standpoint, or even from a financial standpoint. And so it's our job to actually mentor them through that process as much as it is to provide those services.
Well, we've talked about the value of failing, really the value is learning from failure as opposed to just failure, right? So what lesson, and you said now you've learned to do things differently as you've gotten more experience, what painful lesson did you learn a while ago that now you feel as though you're applying often?
Well, the biggest thing that I learned was patience and how you build out companies, as well as being conservative in your approach of leverage, right? So I was highly leveraged the first time I had businesses, and now I have zero leverage. So we're a debt-free environment, and
Does that change how you operate and how you think about the business?
Yes. Yeah. So the idea is I can eat after people on my team eat. And I think that, so I take a more unselfish or, selfless approach to how we build our teams and the people on it. At the same time, someone will come to me and say, hey, it'd be really easy for you to go borrow a couple $1 million and grow even faster. And I'm hesitant to do that because I want to make sure that we're building something that's sustainable for the people around us. And in technology, things pivot on a dime, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We want to make sure that we keep that edge, and having someone that can back you up financially or save you takes a little bit of that edge away and makes you a little bit more less cautious in how you develop.
Well, I think being entirely self-funded, though, does change. First of all, when you started the business, did you have enough funding to give you the runway, or were you scrappy from day one?
Well, we invested about $1.6 million in the company over the first 18 months. And so that's a significant amount of money.
Yeah,
that funding came from me personally. It didn't come from outside sources. And we were able to retire that debt a couple of years ago and put ourselves in a position where, we operate with the flexibility of looking at our profitability as a company to make decisions on what we do in the next quarter or the next year.
Got it, yeah. So as we kind of wind down, I could tell from our conversation that you're trying to incorporate new ideas, new ways of thinking, and so forth as you move forward. What are some books or some things that you do, people you speak with, podcasts like mine that you listen to, that keep you fresh, keep you innovative?
Well, as you grow a company and you get to different levels, I like to say that the same people that can be with you as a toddler are not the same people that can be with you as a teenager that can be with you as an adult. So there's transitions that your company goes through. So there's a book called Traction by Gene Wickman. That's a great book. There are actually companies out there that are based on this book.
The consultants
book.
Around that, yeah.
And so we've never used any outside consultancies, but we've actually built process. We're a process-driven company. And so through this process, we, I like to, if we had to, put a plaque on what we are as a company, I got it from that book, and that is we're an innovation company, right? We're a company that is constantly evolving, that's changing, that's trying to find better ways to service our clients, plus the consumers in the marketplace, in a way that they're likely to engage with it.
Did you actually use that book to sort of build the platform of your business?
No. I used that book after I started seeing negative regression in certain areas or departments as it related to accountability, because culture can constantly shift. The more people or outside influences you add to that environment has a tendency to move that culture either left or right. And so Traction's given me the ability to keep kind of a middle of the road while still giving everyone the flexibility to innovate, right? To have that entrepreneurial spirit and to grow within the processes that they're building. So no one in the company ever feels stymied, but at the same time, they understand that we all have an obligation of the underlying goals, which is why we have the six principles of the company.
And so has everyone in the company read the book or sort of bought into it? Do you share it, talk about it?
So we share the principles within the book, inside of the company, and each department. And there's probably, a couple dozen people that have actually read the book. But, we constantly give out different books like The Culture of Google and things like that to give people an ability to contribute to what our ultimate culture is as a company.
Well, that's cool. And having a framework, I would think, is useful, one that people can refer to and buy into is useful.
You have to drink your own Kool-Aid. If you're telling a consumer or telling a customer that they have to be disciplined in their approach to the market and how they treat each other, you have to be willing to do those same things internally.
Very cool. Well, I think that's a good note to end on. I appreciate it. And I'm going to wrap up this conversation. I'm your host, Dave Tabor. And today I'm ProCo 360's Pro Business Colorado. I've been speaking with Joel Altman, CEO of PIN Business Network, a fast-growing Colorado company helping its clients harness and apply data in ways that spur growth. Joe, thanks for joining me on ProCo 360.
And thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Really interesting. One of the things I really appreciate about conversation, I feel like I got a better understanding of how data is used at a sort of at its most granular level compared to I think what we've been hearing about in the news. This has been really helpful. So thank you.
Thank you.
This is Dave Tabor. Thanks again to show sponsors MicroStar Take Logistics, Community Banks of Colorado, and Jones and Keller. Thanks to my producer Luke Woodruff. This show and past shows are available at proco360.com. Go there to subscribe. Again, that's proco360.com. Thanks for listening.